Let's talk. John Brown. Warbirds to work horses. I haven't been able to get that right all morning. Bob and Keith's book of flight tests. Bob Davey and Keith Wilson have been combining their respective talents for more than 20 years, flying and photographing a variety of aircraft for flight test features and getting the work published around the world. It seems like the perfect job. It's been put together in the new book, which I will call Warbirds to You Know What. Delighted to say that both Bob and Keith join me, obviously from some aircraft hangar with a top secret mission, some beautiful turboprop waiting in the sidelines. Gentlemen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So just explain, let's start from the beginnings then. How did you get involved? When did you get bitten by the flying bug? Bob, I'll start with you first then.
So I started flying when I was a kid. The first word I ever muttered from the pram was jet. And I loved flying. An interesting little story. I was at school and a TV repairman came round to fix the TV in the old days. And he had to get all the Airfix kits off the telly. And he asked my mum, what's the story? And she told him about her 14-year-old son who was really interested in flying. And he said, oh, I'll take him up for a flight then. And so that was Len Boxwell, and that was in the 1970s. And off I went and started flying. And that was the beginning, really.
So TV repairman by day, sort of flying ace by night.
Yeah. And I'm still friends with him. He's still here. He lives in Ipswich. And he's a great lad. And then I joined, I started flying at Southend Flying Club. And then I got taken by the RAF. So I flew with the RAF for 5 years. I lost my medical, unfortunately, so I couldn't fly anymore with the RAF. And retrained as an airline pilot. But I always had that sort of urge to fly military planes, fighters and things, and old planes. So as soon as I could afford it, I bought a share in a Russian trainer for the Yak-52. And that was in the 90s. And I started writing for magazines at the same time. And originally I started working for a rival magazine called Flyer. And then in 2000, I started working for Pilot Magazine. That's where I met Keith. And we teamed up. And so we started working together. And so the flight tests, most of them that are in the book, are actually flight tests that me and Keith have done together in Pilot Mag. They get published as the first rights in Pilot, but then they get second rights all over the world. So we've literally been published in any country you care to mention. Over to Keith.
Keith, how did you start, in your career with aviation?
Well, it actually started with photography first, because I shoot all the images for the books, the air-to-air photography stuff. So I got involved in photography at the age of about 3, when my father stuck a camera in my hand and taught me how to use it. And shortly after that, I was in a darkroom with him processing black and white films. And so that was first. When I went to senior school about the age of 12, we were overlooking an airfield, and I watched the aeroplanes coming and going, and being an inquisitive little brat, we got on our push bikes and cycled to the airfield and had a look around and was totally bitten by the bug. I started flying at 18, got my licenses, and have progressed from there. So while I've never flown commercially, I've always flown privately, and I've also been involved in demonstration flying aeroplanes and ferry flying around the world. And as Bob said, we got together. I started it with a magazine in the 80s, taking air-to-air pictures. Bob and I were put together in 2000, and we've been working successfully ever since. And I think this book is the first volume of what could be a trilogy. And I think, what we do together is probably a pretty high standard of work.
Here's the thing, because obviously, everybody reads car mags or, fashion suits, but that's all on the ground, obviously, if you're taking photography from the air, there must be a few sort of special bits and pieces you need to know. And how does it actually sort of physically operate?
Well, from a photographic perspective, I've just got my cameras. But what we both Bob and I do have, and we rely on very seriously, is a camera ship pilot to fly a second aeroplane alongside the subject, and he has to fly in a very disciplined, safe manner to make it possible for Bob to do all the manoeuvring and for me to take the photographs. So it's, in a way, it's a very well-practiced art, but whereas my skill is with a camera, Bob's skill is with formation flying. And Bob, you know, talk a bit about flying for the camera.
Yeah, I was trained by the Air Force to fly formation. And to do air-to-air photography, you have to be like flying formation badly because you've got to keep moving around and to get different images. Otherwise, you'd only ever get the same picture, you know, like the red arrows. If you took red leaders, you had a camera and red leader for red two and red three, it would be the same shot with just different backgrounds, and you can't do that. So we have to move the thing around. So you have to actually, if you're doing formation flying proper away from the camera, you have to remember to be in position rather than moving up and down and backwards and forwards. And Keith will be sitting there in the aperture. It might be at the doorway or a passenger hatch in one of the planes that we fly. And he'll be peeped out of the side of this aircraft, and he'll be giving me movements. Like he'll be going like, put, you know, move away or come closer or go up or go down or go right or left. He'll give me stuff like that, and then he can call me on the radio. We'll listen to each other as well on the same frequency, and so sometimes I get radio calls from Keith saying, you know, can you do this, can you do that. And we're quite famous for doing what's called a Canadian break. So if you imagine, if you're looking at me in the that's the camera, it's that shot, it's
the side on. So basically they can see into the you can look into the cockpit, is that what you're saying?
It's
from the
yeah exactly. So like it's the aircraft starts there,
yeah,
and we end up with this shot, a sweep away shot, and it's a little bit technical, but you get used to doing it. And we've done it with all sorts of planes, we've done it with fighter planes, we've done it with like executive jets as well, and old antique aircraft and things. So it's quite an interesting sort of dynamic what we do.
I would also add to that that what we do is carefully pre-briefed. We don't go up there and just mix it up as we go along. This is a very dangerous occupation, and as a consequence, it has to be very carefully planned, very carefully briefed, and we do what we said we were going to do. There's no such thing as, oh, shall we try this in the air? That's an absolute no-no. We do not entertain that. And we stick to the brief.
We say we don't have a good idea in the air.
Yes, perfect. That's perfect. Perfect, that, Bob.
Presumably, you've got to clear it with sort of, if you're doing it in the UK, because it's very busy airspace up there. So do you say, okay, we're going to go out over the ocean because it's heavily congested? If you're in the southeast of England, presumably you've got to clear it with air traffic authority, civil aviation authorities, and flight plans and all that sort of stuff. Otherwise, everybody be up there pottering around taking shots of themselves.
Over to you, Bob.
We always find some airspace. Sorry, I'm moving around at the moment. I'm just making my tea. Mm. We always find a piece of airspace where there isn't any controlled airspace. So which airfield we're flying from, we'll always find an area to shoot the air-to-air where there is no. We don't have to talk to anyone on the radio because it's enough talking to each other, let alone having to sort of confirm with an air traffic controller that we're allowed to do what we do. So we'll always find somewhere, won't we, Keith?
Always, yes, I think. And we have our own popular areas, depending upon which airfield we're operating from. Yeah. We will have, we'll have areas where we will go to, we'll know, A, that it's relatively quiet airspace, and B, the backgrounds are attractive, which also makes a difference. And from a personal perspective, I love working above the clouds, which shows the aeroplane off to great, shows all its attributes off beautifully. But it does get interesting sometimes when we're operating in areas and we're doing what I would refer to as unusual attitudes. So we're flying formation aerobatics in to get the pictures that we need. And some of the popular ones are, for example, of the aeroplane that Bob's flying going vertically straight up. In order to get that, it involves diving down, building up speed, pulling hard, going up, and then invariably rolling off the top. So these maneuvers are carefully practiced, carefully choreographed, and produce great pictures.
I'm just thinking, Keith, because obviously you've been doing this for a while now. Did you start off with film, and therefore you wouldn't kind of know, you wouldn't kind of know what you got until you got back, as opposed to digitally? And I'm just imagining you guys sort of like going off at strange angles, and there's a canister going here, and you know you're trying to change the lens there. I mean, it must be, you know, controlled chaos at all times.
Well, when I was operating with film, and yes, I mean I started doing air to air back in the late 70s, so I've been doing it a few years. You'd think by now I'd get it right, but hey, that's just another thought. Yes, when we were using canisters, it was a particular problem that if I dropped something in the aeroplane, that potentially was very, very dangerous. Mm. And I mean seriously dangerous. So I had to wear a jacket that had pockets, big pockets on either side, and I would have live film on the right-hand side, and I would have used film on the left-hand side. And both the pockets had clips on them, which closed them up. So if we did go upside down or whatever else, everything was secure. But in those days, I would shoot anything between 12 and 14 rolls of film, which I had to change in the air. So I got quite adept at rapidly changing film. And Bob, for example, would take a 30-second break while I was doing that, and I'd whip the two films out, change them over, and then move on, and off we would go again. But nowadays, thanks to digital, I still carry two cameras. But invariably, the cards, with double cards in the back of a camera, I've got potentially 600 images on each camera.
Presumably, Bobby, sort of like, are there every time you think, oh, he wants, we've carefully worked on this thing, but he wants me to go around because it wasn't just quite the right glint off the wingtips.
Happens a lot. Yeah, happens a lot.
We know that when we look through the viewfinder, you know, I know when I'm shooting the picture if it's quite right, and anything that is going to go wrong is going to be technical, and there's not too much we can actually do about that. But we will know pretty quickly, and very often I would say, can we do that again, please, Bob? Because, and you know, start the break, for example, slightly lower, slightly closer, slightly faster, slightly slower, whatever. And that's the flexibility that we're trusting with each other, that we work with each other to do.
If you think about it, we've never actually not got the shots that we wanted, have we? Except on two occasions where we've got a phrase, we say knock it off, and everybody involved in the shoot, so that would be the two pilots and the cameraman, it might be an assistant, or the owner of the test subject might be in the plane with me, and anyone at any time can say knock it off, and you don't have to say why, and we'll all go back to base and we'll all have a cup of tea and talk about it, and it's not considered there's no pointing fingers. We just, somebody might have seen or felt or done something that they're not happy with, and they're, that's the end of the shoot. And we've only ever actually done that twice in the air, haven't we? Do you remember?
Yes. Oh, yes. Both with very good reason, Bob.
So there's we've got lots of adages that we use, and one of the things that we say to each other is, if there's three things telling you not to fly, then you don't. And for instance, at the moment, I'm trying to do some test flying in Belgium, and the aircraft's a World War II fighter plane called a Yak 3. And so I've already got two strikes of the three before we start, because the aircraft has never flown. So that's one strike. And I'm in Belgium, and that's another strike. So there's only one other thing going wrong, and I won't go. And so the other day I was out in there for a week, and the weather was just not that perfect, and that's three strikes. So that's three reasons I won't go. And we did a test shoot once upon a time in another World War II fighter, and the pilot of the camera ship wasn't doing what we told him to do. And before the brief, I'd said to him, don't fly below 150 miles an hour, because the other aircraft can't do it. It just physically can't do it. Don't fly into cloud, because the old World War II plane didn't have the right instrumentation to fly in cloud. And don't turn left after takeoff. Well, off we went. He turned left after takeoff. We got airborne. We got to about 5,000 feet over Clacton in Essex. And I started to wobble a bit, and I looked down at my airspeed, because I'm never looking inside. I'm looking at the camera ship, and I looked down at my airspeed, and I was at 130, so I was just about to stall. And then I looked in front of me, and there was a bloody great thunderstorm. And so I said, "Knock it off, Keith, knock it off," and went back to base, and that was the end. Do you remember, Keith?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I can imagine there was some hard, Paddington hard stairs. Let's talk warbirds. I mean, sexy. I know they're killing machines, but you know, the P-51 Mustang must be one of the most charismatic planes there has ever been. You know, the noise of the engine, the handling must be great. It is, if you like, the fighter that changed the world with its drop tanks, etc. I mean, what's that? So when you go to a fly one and B photograph one, it comes with a lot of charisma and a history for both of you.
Do you know what those drop tanks are made of?
Isn't it silk? Is it something nylon or silk or something?
Really? Papier-mâché.
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 Wow. Imagine
isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
it's just incredible, isn't it? It's my favourite plane. I mean, I've got a Yak 3. I've got my own one. But I'll just whisper it. But my favourite aeroplane is actually the Mustang. But I just can't afford it. They're too expensive. But they are the best aircraft I've flown. I've flown 300 types of aircraft. And I've got 16,000 flight hours. And my favourite plane is the Mustang. But they're so expensive. Mm. I've only actually got, I think, 13 and a half hours of total flight time on the Mustang. I've done the course. I've actually done the type rating on the Mustang out in America. And that was the beginning of my proper warbird adventure, because Keith and me, we wanted to be able to up the ante a little bit, and we wanted to be able to do warbird air-to-air instead of just the normal stock aircraft. And it's unusual to have the ability or the apparatus to be able to do warbird air to air. So I went out to Florida in 2015 and did the full type rating with a company called Stallion 51. And Keith and I have since, we've flown quite a few warbird air to airs, which is great because it's good for the book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hence the title.
And presumably, Keith, when you're photographing something like that, because of the whole, it's not a stock photograph, it's an immersive experience. Because it's not just, photography isn't just, it's not an iPhone, go click, everybody thinks they're a bleeding photographer. I work a lot with photographers, it's the bane of their life, the person with the iPhone. But you get an idea for the story, how it's going to look, you know, what you want, you know, what the, otherwise every picture would be the bleeding same, and it wouldn't be such a great book, this one. So therefore, with something like the P-51, you know the excitement you're going to transmit.
I think when we have a good idea, Bob and I have we chat beforehand. We've got a good idea what it is we would like to achieve, and we go up in a planned way and we try and achieve it. And, you know, Bob's talked about sort of the numbers he's done with the different types. From a personal perspective, I'm getting close to photographing my 2,000th different aircraft air to air. So in the sort of close to 50 years I've been doing it, it's been progressing, but the change to the access to warbirds in the last 10 years in particular has meant that the photography we are achieving, now I say we, I just press the button, I'm a technician, Bob flies the aeroplane alongside, and we need a cameraman to make the team up, the camera ship pilot rather, to make the team up. So between us, we achieve the objective, and we aim to make the aeroplanes look as stunning and as spectacular as possible and photograph them in their natural environment.
And that's perhaps the thing. Sorry, Bob. That's the thing, because, okay, we talked the sexy ones, but the book is called, you know, Workhorses. I mean, so there are commercial planes. There are the ones that do the day-to-day work. And the thing of a good report or a good photographer is the fact that you can bring the same enthusiasm. It's like, okay, I've got to do that Cessna or whatever else. You can see how much I know about planes.
One of the workhorses in the book made itself famous as being a CIA aircraft working for Air America out in Laos. And when I went to photographed that one, it flew really, really slowly. I mean, it could actually fly at about 35 miles an hour and not fall out of the sky. So, and it was designed to operate on and off of unprepared strips in mountainous regions and so on. So it was a particularly unusual aeroplane. So for once, we couldn't find a camera ship that was slow enough. So someone said to me quite crazily, well, I've got a Robinson 66 helicopter we can use. Will that work alongside it? So we talked about it and we went, yeah, it'll do fine. So very occasionally we even do something out of a helicopter, but it's not very often.
I was going to say, I mean, speed differentials. I mean, if you're doing, a jet, for example, you've got to have presumably a jet camera plane as well. I mean, how does that work?
Well, you need something fast. It could have a propeller. There are some really fast aeroplanes that with propellers, and we've used all sorts. There's two things I wanted to put in, actually. Keith won't tell you, but he's actually a really good journalist, and some of the stories in the book are actually written by Keith. So he actually wrote, as well as photographed, the Helio Courier, which is the CIA plane, and there are other aircraft in book one that Keith actually wrote rather than me. And I'd actually put Keith as the professional journalist of the two of us, because I tend to get bored if it's not quick and fast and fun, and Keith can write anything. He's a proper professional. I'm just looking at the book, actually, and seeing, trying to remember which camera ship we flew with each aircraft. And Keith, you could tell me, with the Vampire jet, what did we use?
An Aztec.
Oh, yeah.
Piper, twin-engine Aztec with the safety hatch out of the left-hand side.
And what about the seaplane?
We used a Yak 52 for that.
It's a lot of flashy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think somewhere in the book is a list of all the camera ship drivers. I think I made a point of actually acknowledging their efforts. So somewhere in there, it actually tells you what each... yes, it does. What each camera ship driver was. So I'll just check that one for you. The Aviat Husky Pup was, as you quite rightly put out, flashy in the Yak 52.
So now we did one of the stories. We did an airliner, BA-146, and that was the last plane I flew professionally for CityJet, which was part of Air France KLM. And so I wrote a day in the life of an airline pilot, but Keith, years before, had flown that aircraft doing an air-to-air, haven't you? And what did you use then?
I was in another jet.
All right.
I was working from another jet aircraft.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so it varies, but we don't... The most important ones, really, are the aerobatic formation flights, where we've got to have the camera ship pilot, the camera ship driver... and his aeroplane have to be very, very good, very, very competent. And both Bob and I are happy that A, I'm going to trust my life in his hands, and B, Bob's going to trust his life flying alongside him. So it's very much a team sport.
There's we keep coming back to this camera ship pilot, don't we, if you notice?
Yes.
And it's crucial.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're already a known... substance, me and Keith, and we're known in the industry as well. The variable is the owner of the test subject, what he can put up with if it's aerobatics, and what he's happy to do. A lot of people have never flown within 500 feet of another plane, because they'd get a call from the Civil Aviation Authority if they did. And there we're sitting 10 feet apart, wingtip to wingtip, you know, so it's an unusual thing what we do. But the big variable, the biggest of all, is the camera ship driver.
I just want to go back to the owners, because obviously a lot of them, especially they've got replica Spitfires or Mustangs or whatever their favourite plane is, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, they tend to be rather wealthy individuals who probably just pop up and, you know, do a little bit of flying, but normally on a beautiful day, you know, somewhere in the middle of the States or in Florida where it's nice, nothing's around. They probably never sort of pushed it in the way that you guys would do. And you must get some sort of concerned looks over your time.
It's an interesting dynamic because most of the high net worth people that fly these very expensive planes, that own these expensive planes, and suddenly they're in the hands of me and Keith, you know, and we're quite like a bit of a laugh, two laughabouts, you know, we have a good crack and don't take it too seriously, really. And then suddenly we've all got to smarten up, and there's some chap with a Mustang or something like that that's worth about £5 million. He's never flown it anywhere near another plane, and we rock up and we're going to go and fly it 10 or 20 feet apart, you know. But the big one is the camera ship driver. Mm. It's the, we've only got a handful of people that we use, and we treat them like deities because they're the best in the business, and we've brought a few of them on. You know, they've actually not done this job before, and we've brought them because we sort of spotted something. Keith, I'm thinking of Matt.
Oh yes, very, very good in the Nanchang.
Yeah, and we've got this new guy now, and he's never done it. He did a formation course at North Weald. I know he did that, but he's just got it, hasn't he? That guy, and he's a new guy, and we love him, don't we?
Well, yes, but then he understands what it is we're trying to achieve, but he communicates with us all the time, and he does what he's asked to do. Yeah. So it's just reassuring. But what I would also add in there is a couple of times in the past, a camera ship pilot has seen something going wrong and has basically got the aeroplane out of the way and saved my life. So personally, I do trust my life with them.
Mm.
Yeah.
What's the best bit of it? Is it the, you know, up above the clouds as the sun's, and do you, is it middle of the day? Is it best time to shoot morning, the sun coming? I mean, I don't know, sun coming up, etc. Does it depend on where you are and what the brief is?
Sadly, it depends very much on where we are, what we're doing, what time things are available. In an ideal scenario, the best light is the first thing in the morning and the last thing at night, which is called which is often referred to as the golden hour. From a purely aesthetic perspective, shooting above the clouds tends to make the aeroplane look bright. It looks where it belongs. But the reflected light, and here we go technically, the reflected light that comes off the cloud and back up illuminates the bottom half of the aeroplane. So the aeroplane is better lit above the clouds than it would be if we were working below the clouds.
Yeah,
so it's all about, if we had the best laid plans, we would always do it at a certain time. We don't. We have to be very flexible, and we have to take the opportunities when they present themselves.
I'm just thinking it's a massive diffuser hanging off the back of the camera plane from...
Not quite.
Yeah. The best pictures that we've ever taken have never been an accident, have they, Keith? They're always planned. It's dawn and dusk, and it's a certain cloud formation, and we just get it, don't we? And there are things that they're so logical when you think about it, but if you've never done it before, it's just not obvious. I mean, my old grandfather used to say to me that common sense isn't all that common. And if you're flying along and we've got our expensive selves to the location of the shoot, and we've got the expensive plane ready to fly, and we've got the expensive camera ship ready to fly, and we all take off, and then we're in an overcast of cloud, and you look around, and it would be easy just to say, "All right, knock it off, let's go back." And then you think, "Hold on a minute." You look at we've looked at the forecast all morning, and the forecast said there's going to be broken cloud, and you look around the countryside from 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 feet, and you see some bright countryside. Well, that's bright because the sun's shining on it. So it's, let's head to that area there, and sure enough, when you get there, there's blue sky and the sun, you know. And it's so obvious now we talk about it, but it's not obvious if you've never done it.
I've got 1 minute left before we crash into the news, so what is the, you know, what do you hope that people learn or appreciate from warbirds to work horses?
I've got it. When I was a kid growing up, we used to have these A3 sized books, coffee table books, And I just loved them as a child, and I'd get one for Christmas, and I wanted the same book. I wanted to be able to open it, and we've got a soft spine on this book, so it although it's an A4, it opens to A3, and you can put it on your coffee table, and there'll be this beautiful picture of some fantastic aeroplane.
Inspiring new pilots. Keith, what do you hope the people learn? We've got 10 seconds.
I would echo what Bob said, but in addition to which, it's an education in reading about it. So if you're not sure what a Mustang's like to fly or a Yak 3, here's your chance.